Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm Assistant Director for Special Collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to the Michigan Writers Series, another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. This is our last event of the Winter 2007 series, and as the saying goes, we save the best for last, because we not only have one, but two writers appearing tonight. One who is returning to us after a previous reading, a terrific reading, Jack Riddle. And the second reader is Chris Dombrowski. Both will be reading tonight for you. Chris will begin the reading, and following Chris, Jack will do the reading. But before that, I'd like to introduce both of them to you tonight. Jack Riddle has published four collections of poetry, three chapbooks, two literary texts, two anthologies, and more than 300 poems in various literary magazines. His most recent collection, Broken Symmetry, was published in 2006, along with a chapbook of circus poems, Outside the Center Ring. Sharon Dolan and then poet laureate Billy Collins selected his Against Elegies for the Chapbook Award from the Center for the Book Arts in New York City. Riddle was chosen in 1996 by the Carnegie Foundation as the Michigan Professor of the Year. More than 40 of his students in the past 15 years have gone on to MFA programs and to publish their work. For 36 years, Riddle has taught poetry writing at Hope College, where he founded the Visiting Writers Series. This past fall, he was invited to read at the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival. Chris Dombrowski, who was a former student of Jack Riddle. Chris's poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Bloomsbury Review, Colorado Review, Crazy Horse, Mid-American Review, New Letters, Ninth Letter, Orion, Seneca Review, and other journals, and have been anthologized in Joyful Noise, an anthology of American spiritual poetry. His awards include the Associated Writing Program's Intro Award, Alliger Juniper's National Poetry Prize, and a poetry fellowship from the University of Montana, where he received his MFA. Born in Lansing, Michigan, Dombrowski works as a river guide, poet in the schools, and creative writing instructor at the University of Montana in Missoula, where he lives with his family. In the spring 2007, he will serve as writer-in-residence at Interlochen Center for the Arts, where my daughter will be going this summer for creative writing. So will you please welcome, first of all, Chris Dombrowski, and following Chris, Jack Riddle.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you, Peter, very, very much. Thank you all for coming. It's really odd to see a bunch of familiar faces tonight, and it's just a great honor to be here reading with Jack, who, as Peter said, was my teacher at Hope College. I have another former teacher here tonight, too, from East Lansing High School, Mrs. Beth Lawrence. The room is filled with teachers, so I'll start by reading a few poems and then close with an essay. So if you're not a huge fan of poems, there's something to wait for. It's like donuts at the end of church or something. This first poem is called Get Up, John. Get Up, John is an old traditional bluegrass tune. I think that's all you need to know about it. Get Up, John. Here comes dawn, and nothing rosy about her fingers. Nothing to suggest gender whatsoever. Stove flame blue. And some hand must have turned the burner on. Little tongues licking gradually the teapot of us a boil, cooking off a giardia of stars, the dregs of our nightmares. Who will place his fingers in the nail marks, come near enough to smell death in its hair? Already, we've some of us slid back into our bodies, restirring the air, our breaths stirred all night, whoever we are while we sleep, and gone about believing we are here. Ambulance sirens assure us a plum's sour skin. What's become of the poppies, dried, all but greenless, etc.? But the yearling child, reaching into the lineaments of sun, lancing between his crib bars, how might this shame us that they seem to seem graspable to him? How to carry water. There is the bird beak's way and the way of the woman with child, the eye's way and the way of the well bucket. The oak tree's way is not unlike that of the cloud or the long, dry summer it was when the bird song stopped and the woman stood tiptoe looking down the well. Perched on the handle of an unstrung pail, a wren fluttered its wings without note. A leaf floated, sinking slowly as the pail, the rust holes the caterpillar chewed, sipping in the weight of last year's skies. For a moment of months, the woman is the well, until the sky inside her opens and she stands above it, holding a bucket full of leaf song, of wren beak raindrops, of clouds staring up like eyes. I think this room's too small. There's nowhere to go. It's just... they tell you to look at the back of the room, but there is no... It's really close. I think I'll read this. I've been teaching a class this spring up at Interlochen about the prose-verse hybrids. We started back with the haiku poets, Basho, Issa, and Busan, and then we went on to Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North, which is like a bunch of travel sketches that he has linked with small haiku. And so that was kind of our jumping off point. And if you, the haiku poets are amazing because what they do is they distill the world in three lines. And they, when they do it right, they the world and all its balance is just in this tiny little kernel. So that has nothing to do with this poem whatsoever. But it is a bit, it's a bit of a prose verse hybrid. It it has some poetry in it and it has some prose. And I was looking at the river today, which looks big, snow melt and rain, and I thought I would read this. It's called I Canonize Dick Curran. The river, as they say, is running off. That's what we say in Montana. If the river, the river's in runoff. So the river, as they say, is running off. To where? With what? To the last place current would carry a body if a body lay itself beside slipping banks, knelt even, and asked to be moved. Not the placid tour you might envision, having never seen mill pulp seeping acridly from settling ponds, having no idea how long a cliff-borne hydraulic could hold you under. I counted once, singing I'll fly away three times before the brutish swirl spit back the huge cedar it had swallowed with such nonchalance. I thought back then I wanted water, the great beast flowing over and around me, wanted to be eroded, spread in flood across the sedge-lit bottoms, a stillness, in other words, the living aren't allowed. A man I had watched, though, named Dick Curran, would ford the cold flow in jeans faithfully that winter, pulling braces of whitefish from the hole. lop each head with his knife handle priest and leave them lying atop the stones I wanted to be, glistening in the sun's midday stare. I knew it like a liturgy, the hunched figure squinting at the union of line and water until light quivered and man and river were likewise joined, just elements, forces of nature. Then by its tail, he'd grasp the fish, split its skull, a nod waved to me across the riffle, tipped hat. At certain moments of high stillness, I expected him to walk onto and across the water, the fish shuddering, slipping back. Of course, he'd simply sit there on his bucket beneath the thin glaucoma sky while my toes grew so cold I thought to offer them for bait. "We are just bait," he said. The evening I found him sprawled out on the icy two-track, his scattered catch staring blindly up at the wide arcs of crows. "Help me right here before they freeze." And so we slit the bellies of those fish open, ran the row out with our fingers, then rode in the truck's warm silence to his basement room full of tackle, fillet knives, blades on the counter beside his crude oil landscapes. "Something to do," he said, pointing to the paintings to mark the days. In essence, what Santa Lucia said when asked why she carried her pocked-out eyes in a dish. Something to do while dodging the pimps she refused to whore for, or strolling across the Swedish countryside, cradling that bowl like a luminaria, a living half-testament, depending, of course, on the myth to the scripture she often canted. If the eyes are sound, the whole body is filled with light. Songless, Curran carried maggots beneath his tongue to keep them alive, and a white bucket filled sometimes with fish he boiled and served with salt and lemon butter to the folks at Friendship Manor Retirement Center, and once to a young man who believed they existed only on ornate canvases and Baroque tales. Never saw him again, but read he died late one August, the river predictably low enough to cross. If you haven't heard Jack's voice before, Jack should have been saying Dick Curran's lines in that, because he has such a great voice. I normally banter a lot between poems, but I think since I know so many people here who know me well, my shtick is not going to fly, so. I'll read just a couple more poems, and then I'll read this brief essay. Fragments with dusk in them. We were taught to count kestrels on wires like coins in our pockets. Whole years we recalled by color. That torch year, tanager, fox, sandstone, sage. Droughts revealed the river's former ways, oars wedged between boulders, a derailed boxcar, conductor's leather cap. A recluse fell in love with certain shadows spilled across her cellar floor, and among the east's first stars were the occasional words jeweling up at dusk with junkyards, chrome hubcaps, as mirrors struck small skies across our bodies. I said I'd read one Michigan poem tonight. So this is real new. Still a bunch of marks on what words to take out and what ones to leave in. But I have been You were worried I was going to do that, weren't you? Thanks. Okay. This is called Study for the Ridgeline Blue in Winter. And I just am very taken by the color of the sky right before, right after the sun sets, especially in the Northwoods. We paint a lot with Luca. Luca is my two and a half year old son. He paints a lot. And I got this idea to write a poem about that color blue because our 299 watercolors wouldn't quite produce it. This is called Study for the Ridgeline Blue in Winter. It throbs up from the darkening draws, eluding dusk's clutch. Calls out, and the owl calls back, answering with her own ample cawn. When the world was flat, we thought darkness fell. Now we know it rises, fire-like from earth, its flames spindling up the oak's trunks, engulfing ridge and canopy. The resulting smoke, then, hue of a breath exhaled by a late arriving disciple come to examine the charred chaos of day, such a staunch monk igniting itself again. The odorless remains, then, the hanging particulate, try not to breathe it in, a mute coyote's coat flecked with snow. Clear, cold-drawn tear, two children escaping with the last unshattered mirror, signals from which they send to no one all night, no, no one, until dawn. I'll read this last, poem is a mushroom picking poem and a morel picking poem, and hopefully it'll transition right into this brief essay. I had a bunch of teacher picked out, but this is a poem called Rex's Georgic, and a Georgic is like a kind of instructive piece on how to. Virgil's Georgics were on, you know, beekeeping or whatever, and this character Rex is kind of a backwoods guy, and you'll hear two voices in the poem. One is Rex's voice, and the other is more kind of head in the clouds, poetic voice. It's called Rex's Georgic, hunting morels in last year's burn. The morels that pop around here, I think, mostly are in the hills and the river bottoms, but in Montana we get a great crop of them that come after the forest fires, and their spores are kept up in the pine needles for years and years and years, and only when the forest fires come and turn those to ash do they go into the ground. And the spores are remarkably transient. They can go anywhere. Like, just going like that sends them, you know, miles and miles away. So, and they taste really, really good in an omelet with jack cheese and maybe a little, yeah. Rex's Georgic, hunting morels in last year's burn. White whorls, three flags of trillium splash up from charred ground. A ponderosa's boiled sap. Sometimes, even in the spring, even after the long snows, you can find a trunk still smoldering. Puckett, you are the worst goddamn mushroom hunter I ever saw, like some drive-by mushroom hunter. Look, slug always finds his shroom. Crow caw, crow mew, wind from far away, crow bark, wind in the dead chimes of the aspen. Some folks will rub soot on their face for luck, paint warrior lines and such, but it ain't about luck at all. Matter of fact, you know Chick Alexander, Judge, lost his son Abe when their baseball rolled under the porch? Right in front of you, next to your foot. Swallowtails, cabbage whites, the dark scat of denning wolves, little azures that love the dung. Those are butterflies and moths. I'm sorry I didn't say that. So Abe goes digging after the ball and unwraps a den of young rattlers. 37 bites and that's counting. You do know Chick, right? Yeah, well, he's a hell of a mushroom hunter. Dead deer, button buck, the difference between thistles and burrs. What the dead do is none of our business. That swale there is brimful of ticks, so watch it. Had a lady friend once send me all these tick drawings after she left. She was thinking about me still, said I was a tick under her skin. Six swift clouds, could enough of them erode a mountain? Nope, I never found them on that hill, though I did find 15 pounds of weed growing there one year. No buds, but back then a leaf would get you high. You just stepped on one. Other boot. Sun dogs, two of them, a whole hillside of trillium, roots the Nez Perce used to boil to arouse their sleeping lovers. Now I have heard that before, knew a couple tried it once, screwed so long and hard their short hairs knotted. That's a glacier lily. You can eat those. Watch. Thank you for laughing at that. I think I can get through this essay in just a few minutes. The essay is called Kana, which is a Japanese word of like exclamation, and the haiku poets use it to indicate a sense of wonder. I think this essay kind of grew out of reading the haiku poets, mostly in translation by American poet Robert Haas, although there are millions and millions of other translations, but that happened to be the book I was teaching out of this spring. And last spring, I spent a good deal of time in the woods with our son Luca, who was then about 18 months or so. And I had a week or so with not too much work to do. So I was at home watching Luca, and these beautiful golden river bottom morels were popping. And when they're there, you either go pick them or they dry up or someone else goes and picks them. So I like to pick them, eat them until I get tired of them, sell maybe 6 or 8 pounds worth to one of the good restaurants in town. So Luca just had to come along with me for the week. And he started out really liking it, and then he got really tired of it. But I started out talking about teachers, and I hope this essay says something to the effect that this young child is an amazing teacher. It's called Kana, with an exclamation point. To reach the honey hole, I have to cross a channel of knee-high, silt-stained river with 20-month-old Luca, my mushroom-picking partner, on my shoulders. I wade in, the soles of my sandals clamoring for purchase on the moss-covered cobbles, the cold flow kiting my pant legs, Luca's knees tightening around my neck. Ashore, cuffs draining, I tell the boy, we'll beeline it for the old burn, where I sense the freshest morels are poking out in droves from the undergrowth. But 10 yards into our beeline, I'm crouching to pluck a 3-inch-tall yellow morel, Morchella esculenta, from a patch of Solomon seal, then 2 thimble-sized from the dappled shade of a ratty cottonwood. Bright red thread lashed to our ears, a red shafted flicker's call slits the quiet of the wet May woods. What's that? Luca asks. That's a flicker, I say, mimicking its call with a whistle. Flicka, he says, then tests the air with his own scream-like rendition. The bird responds to neither. Shifting, squirming on his perch, the boy wants down. I let him off, my shoulder muscles uncrimping, tingling as they release the memory of his weight. then spot a small gathering of the honeycombed conical caps on a south-facing ditch bank, a little board meeting of morels. "Look, bud, mushrooms," I say, nearly diving to slice my stationary quarry off at the stem. "And how about this one?" I say, marveling at a hand-tall specimen. None too impressed, he stares into the budding branches, their wide grasp of sky. It's a strange creature whose pulse quickens at the sight of a fungus, and strange I must look, hunched over the old overgrown road, creeping more slowly than he, to my son, who seems content to watch sunlight loosen beads of dew slide down grass blades. I must look stranger yet to the eyes of the woods, the deer we don't see, but that certainly see us, the pair of red tails casting their shadows intermittently alongside ours, a two-legged with a smaller two-legged by his side, bowing now and then to gather something from the leaf rot. For weeks now, the weather, hot spell after hard rains, has had me thinking mushrooms, and almost daily I've been bringing Luca into the woods in search of the mother lode we haven't quite found yet. The proverbial son dragged along on his father's fishing trip, who stares in wonder at his surroundings all day, only to hear his quarry-obsessed father exclaim at sunset, "Isn't this beautiful, son? Did you see that?" Luca has been the best, if slightly annoyed, company. My true field guide. To date, we've picked a few ball caps full. Mostly, I pinch off the hollow stems and place the moist caps where the boy can find them so I can hear him say, "And a mushroom!" But he's found a few on his own, surprising me with his keen eye. We're not looking for the Aunt Edna lode, though. We're searching for the gnome's stash, the Shangri-La, from which we can fill a double-layered paper grocery sack as quick as we can pick. I've gotten gluttonous, I know, but I can taste the sliced caps cooked down in butter, salt, and pepper, and piled atop a jack cheese omelet. I'm thinking mushroom reduction over elk backstrap. I'm thinking stuff the trophy mushrooms with poached Oregon salmon and fry them ever so lightly, tempura style. I'd like to give a few bowlfuls, too, to our 82-year-old neighbor, Frank. I'm so generous, who, before his knees went bad, loved to hunt the hard-to-find fungi. Most of all, I'd like to harvest a few extra pounds to trade with the best chef in town for two meals at his bistro, to which I would take the well-deserving mother of my picking partner on a date I couldn't otherwise afford. "Where are we?" Luca asks. By now, we're deep in the old burn, stooped over the stumps whose charred bark flakes off in scales. The morels are everywhere, thickest in the thickest nettle patches. I cut further in, not answering the boy I hold on my hip, craning over every other step to pull morels from the pithy soil, not worrying what effect this inane imbalance calisthenic will have on my hernia, not pausing to smell each fruit's damp, nutty scent, or to break a piece of burnt bark from a tree and mark our faces with it, not stopping to look at the scratches the whipping, thorny branches are leaving on his arms and legs. And suddenly, the ground is a blur, a Monet of thistles, grass, and crumbling tree trunks. I can tell from the rhythm, the rising time of my twig-cracking steps, that I'm moving too fast. I backtrack, stare at the ground again, old stumps of shrooms I just picked. Seemingly everywhere a moment ago, the morels have disappeared, slinked back into the ground. Could I get any further ahead of myself? Could I move any more hurriedly after these fruits of mulch and fire that do not move? Often, while prepping a meal, I'll slice open a cap and find along its inner walls a slug. Slug always finds his shroom, an old timer once told me. Slow down, move at Luca pace. He's stumbling through the brambles with his lips pressed together, pushing a motor-like sound from his mouth, trying to imitate, I assume, the racket-causing, maple-boring, pileated woodpecker that startled him a few moments ago. May light, soft as the underside of a leaf, falls on his face, on his head, which must be warm. Go on, great white mushroom hunter. Run your fingers through the dark mat of his hair and feel the sun collecting there. Push your nose into his scalp and smell spring taking root. Kana, the Japanese haiku poets called it. That stutter of wonder we receive when an image of the world takes root in us. A snap in time. A sudden salience on the psyche that arrests the senses or emotions enough to cauterize itself on the mind's otherwise distracted, refractive surface. Something to which our awareness has just been tuned. A small, stick-colored fungus that appears and becomes metaphoric of anything desired or worked for and simultaneously right before our eyes. A winter ago, I drove my then horse-obsessed son to our friend's small spread in the Bitterroot so that he could see and perhaps feed a live horse. The whole drive up the valley, he studied drawings of horses and books and pointed out the window at the pastured rowans and snowy fields, saying, "Nay, nay, nay, nay." When we reached the ranch, our friend brought out his daughter's toy horses, and Luca galloped them around the close-cropped carpet meadow, looking over now and then to remind us of their presence. Nay, 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 nay. But when we walked outside to the stall and Rose, a large chestnut mare, cantered up to the fence to greet us, I felt a shiver of realization carom through the body I carried. Nostrils dilated with curiosity, long face cocked inquisitively, the big horse stared the boy down. Luca gazed for a while into the glossy brown eye that harbored his reflection, then turned to look at David and me and decreed, "Nay, nay, nay, nay." Now that's a horse, he meant, if I read his inflection correctly. It's humbling to think that 17th century Japanese haiku master Basho would have rendered that anecdote in a three-line poem, perhaps something like, "Small boy made smaller in the horse's eye." But better, more precise, more resonant. Picking morels today with one eye on the ground and the other on Luca, I keep recalling a poem by Issa, another practitioner of the form. "Her roe veering off," he wrote, "the peasant woman plants toward her crying child." With their uncanny eye for detail, beads of dew on the caterpillar's hair, wrote Busan, the third master, the haiku poets would have likely made amazing morel hunters. Issa, who had a knack for describing insects and cobweb-strung interiors and was enamored of children, might have liked cooing like a dove, the boy, before he knows the word for dove, which formed in my mind today. But Issa's intrepid self-reprimanding, "The moon and the flowers, 49 years, walking around, wasting time," chides my task-oriented brain in the face of Luca's goallessness. Better to keep my eyes tuned to my young Sherpa, spirit compass. Closer to levitating than any monk, boy gazing at hovering hawk. Some days the double-layered paper grocery bag that is the heart or the heart's memory brims over with images such as these, moments of kana at Luca's kana, his amazement at the everyday. Use the commonplace to escape the commonplace, Busan wrote. And some days I can feel Luca's wonder spurring me into deeper relation with the world despite what I know about the world. The world with its ironies and cruelties that daily knocks my romantic impulse on its ass and often causes me to retreat into a kind of spiritual hesitancy. This morning, for instance, I can't stop wondering if the soil from which my beloved morels have grown is laced with the same mind tailings, arsenic, and lead that have made the upper portion of our valley an EPA Superfund site. Is this the announcement? Okay. Should I wait for it?
Sure.
Okay. I thought I could work that in somehow, but I can't. The irony of the organic foraged meal that leaves toxic grins on the foraging family's lips. Albeit imaginative, this line of thinking quickly gains a dangerous momentum as the mind's ability to sensationalize or wax ironic never ceases to amaze. One moment I am piling morels into my outstretched t-shirt, the next I am envisioning each of the felled fruits as a suicide bomb victim stacked alongside a dusty Baghdad side road. Gripped by this casual cynicism, I pull back, disengage. But Luca's moment-to-moment discoveries pull me back in, drag me the way he's dragging a newly found whitetail antler shed behind him like a rake. Come along now. Toppling the coveted morels, $35 a pound in Chicago markets. As he goes, he is either in a daze of boredom or he is walking Kana, penetrated each step by the world, not penetrating it. It's tempting to call his spirit naivete, but it's not. It's wisdom we lose along the way. Holocaust surviving Polish poet Czesław Miłosz echoes this paradox when he writes, "Pure beauty and benediction, you are all I gathered from a life that was bitter and confused, in which I learned about evil, my own and not my own. Wonder kept seizing me, and I recall only wonder. I know the world is dying from my eyes, and that my affection for the world is part of its destruction. I know it is, as someone wrote, safer to dwell within the domains of irony. Yet here I am walking under cottonwoods atop centuries of dead leaves that, budding each year, sticky to the touch, smelled like this. A sweet, long, steeped tea, the sweaty neck of a lover, an infant's head. Last night, after soothing a nightmare-stricken Luca, I fell asleep alone on the couch and dreamed I was still holding his small frame to my chest. His heartbeats beating into my heart sent a raw blue wind pulsing through my dream body. I awoke quickened, a layer of the infinitely layered veil blown away. Now, just now, Luca scrambles out from underneath a deadfall he's been referring to as his cave and hands a brittle leaf to me. And a mushroom. Oh, thank you, I say, and place the leaf with what we've gathered, a heaping load of morels, a bright orange flicker feather, a few rocks, a forkhorn whitetail antler shed. Mid-afternoon, sun high, birds loud, dewdrops hard to find. Luca's nap is calling. I zip the bulging paper bag inside my backpack so our cash won't spill when we wade the river channel again. We'll cross the river channel and still be here. Where are we? What canopy and of clouds and birdsong have I lived beneath? Thank you.
After a week where we've lived with language being abused and distorted, what a joy, Chris. Thank you for restoring the way it should be. And thank you, Peter, Michael, Diane, for making things happen. Sue for my water. This is a big rite of passage night here. You have all these read with Chris. I knew he was going to write that well the moment he showed up. And Sarah Lammers is back here. Sarah is a poet who has a new collection just out from, called City Without Trees. Go buy it. Speaking of, $15, $8, and $12. I have to do that, or the publishers won't ever pay my expenses again. Don't breathe into that thing. You can hear, right? That's working, Ari. I always like to start a reading with this poem, this breathing. Can we lower the breathing, or should I just not breathe?
It's your beard.
Oh, it's mine. It's not my breathing. I would like to start with this poem. My mother's written me a letter every week for 36 years. Astonishing letters that are, well, she lives in retirement place now, so there are things like, Henrietta has been seeing Elmer a lot lately. She writes them all in pencil. She hates computers. She hates pens. She's a Luddite. And every single one is a pencil. In fact, a couple weeks ago, it started out in pen, and then it went, oh, my God, I'm using a pen. Just a second. And then in came the pencil. This is a poem called The History of the Pencil. This is a poem I always like to start off with. You know, Henry David Thoreau's family owned a pencil factory. And Leonardo da Vinci wrote mirror writing. He had a maimed one hand, and the other hand was, he would write mirror writing. Imagine that. This is that time where you insult the audience by telling them what they already know because you're such a hotshot poet person. That I think that's it. The History of the Pencil. Even as you sit staring at the light on the new computer that came with speakers and discs that hold golf games, soundtracks from the movies of the 40s, and a way to rhyme every word except those stubborn loners, silver, purple, orange, and month, you have to wonder how this most elemental of juxtapositions, this marriage that few families would allow, this wedding of wood and lead, wandered into some pause in the daydreams of whom? Even Thoreau, that son of the pencil-making family who recorded every move of a leaf, who listed each essential object for a 12-day trek into the woods of Maine, matches, soap, 2 pieces, old newspapers, 3, and blanket, 7 feet long, neglected to note his pencil. Imagine. Held by the hand of the keeper of Walden, as he, in all his assured solitude, attended to everything in his burrowing but you, the scribbler's one essential companion. Wouldn't you feel much like the friend who's been there all along, who leaves quietly out the back door when the famous come to call? Or the good dog who stays loyal day after abandoned day? Or the name changed to something more alluring that sits and wonders why you are walking away. I am a pencil, said Toulouse-Lautrec to one of the rouged and rowdy-legged dancers he let become a gray line kicking high over his lonely head in the dance hall. Even Leonardo, whose mind would never let anything escape from the possibility of being better, wrote those mad, mirror-written obsessions, his maimed right hand dangling like a sash, and sketched his own hand sketching without ever thinking that the tedious brush could give way to something humbler, more subservient. And did it never enter the mind of some poor hunter-gatherer who surely heard the tunes of the very beasts and berries he searched for? I'd like to keep what I likely forget. Maybe if I... Was it there that his mind opened into the first existential blank? And when he told her and all his cave companions what he'd like to be able to do, did they each just nod and go back to picking out what had gathered in their hair throughout the day? So now, as you sit stunned at the mere accumulation of words filed, edited, viewed, inserted, formatted, spun into websites, downloaded, and upgraded into numbers nothing but infinity seems able to record even now, on some desk, maybe yours, in an old jelly jar, or a ceramic elephant with a hole in its back that your niece in third grade gave you for Christmas, or in a German beer stein or hand-painted wooden Chinese calligrapher's pen holder, sprouts a fistful of pencils, Rettke's preservers of dolor, each one waiting, as it always has, to lie like a faithful love between your thumb and finger, to let your words be the only ones they will ever know, even as they give themselves to the alchemy of everything, becoming empty phrases, an X to mark the spot, reminders to pick up bread and coffee, maybe a note written to a friend whose dog has died. I always like to do this because I'm so lucky. I have a daughter who's an artist, and so the covers are her paintings. And this is the only way I can get them, because I can't afford them. I put them up in the refrigerator when she was little. You'd think she'd give her old man a painting. But, you know, I say, can I have one, you know? And she goes, a couple grand, Dad, you know? So if you don't buy the book, you can have this. This painting hangs, was sold for $1,000, and you can just cut this out, and you can... Here's a poem that might be familiar to some of you, and if not all of you, I'll be amazed. It's called It's April, and It Should Be Spring. The gods are tired of staking fires against the window, a cold rain. Each night, the hour hand moves time and us closer to the light. No one wants to go out. No one wants to stay in, and the rain. Robins do their silly walk across the lawn, dead grass dangling from their beaks. Crocuses raise their purple risk through the ice-crusted mulch of maple, oak, beech, and willow. They last a day. Clumps of daffodils stay, blossom tight. We want to put away sweaters. What would the saints do? We haul in more wood. It is raining. Sunday, and it is raining, and it is cold. Winter's wedged itself into a crack along the equinox. We know in time the trees will bud, the flowers rise and bloom. We do what we can. We wait. My mom is well over 4 feet, and she's been a pop culture fan ever since she was a kid. She threw herself up on the stage and grabbed Sinatra's feet, and she made sure my sister and I saw the Beatles. Now she's madly in love with Bruce Springsteen. She has everything, every video, every CD, everything. You know, on your wall you have pictures of Chris, Mary, Luca, family. She has the boss. She was visiting when we were having some work done on our house. And the poem's called The Drywallers Listen to Sinatra While They Work. This morning, my mother, here for the holidays, is washing the breakfast dishes when Al, wiry, coated with drywall dust, takes her hand and says, I bet you love Sinatra. Dance. The acrid smell of plaster floats through the room. Frank is singing All or Nothing at All. And Al leads my mother under the spinning ballroom lights across the new subfloor. He is smiling. She is looking over his shoulder. The other guys turn off their sanders. Al and my mother move through the dust. Two kids back together after the war. Sinatra holds his last note. It's been 7 years since I danced, my mother says. Then it was in the kitchen, too. Al smiles again, says, come on then, sweetheart, biting off his words like the ends of the good cigars he carries in his pocket. Sinatra's singing My Funny Valentine, and my mother lays her hand in Al's, and they dance again, she looking away when she catches my eye, Al leading her back across the layers of dust. I think America needs to change the new year. I'm allowed to do this. I think the new year needs to start on Memorial Day. Everybody makes these New Year's resolutions, but actually everybody makes resolutions on Memorial Day. That's when Americans make their resolutions. You know that. You know, this year, war and peace. I'm not going to plant impatience this year. I'm not going to do it. And this is a little poem about that. Just what happens on Memorial Day and how we're going to change our lives. It's Memorial Day, and here comes summer, and by God, this summer. A few days before another Memorial Day weekend, you think maybe if you screened in the porch, you think fly fishing, you think rereading Middlemarch or your grandmother's recipes. There's summer ahead, lots of days, plenty of pots to make a container garden, mounds of begonias, asters, foxglove, cosmas, and coleus. There's your sister's wedding, her third, you think. It will be small, huge, both, doesn't matter, and it does, it's not at all the same. What is the same is your penmanship, no matter how many calligraphy lessons or how hard you've tried to change the way you cross your T's. What's the same as birdsong? And the taste of pepper. You switch cereals, you turn off the television, the back burner, the boss, the highway. There's a little restaurant where you can order garlic mashed potatoes and switch to blueberry pie. You think if you throw away your shoes, buy a little car, a little place in the country, make a little sense. You say yes to 4 a.m, yes to the dust on the table, no to the days of the week, to wind chimes, No. 2 lead pencils in the West Coast. You know there's wax in your ears. There's time enough to tell. There's room for it here or even there. It's just that the dog is asleep and the cats are asleep and the water is running, running where your mother said it would run, running while the welcome mat stays out. You wonder if you thought of Buddha, but no one can think of Buddha. So you think of Jesus thinking of Buddha. Jesus thinking of Krishna, thinking of Buddha, who is not thinking, who is letting the dream of a better kitchen wander off with the end of a novel. No, you think of the nuthatch climbing down the dead maple outside your bedroom window. You think of the kid on the yellow bicycle, pedaling like mad, like crazy, like wildfire down the street. Let's go to the circus. My father was a basketball coach, and my mother came from circus people, and I've never had to face reality my entire life. And it was fascinating. I mean, it was just amazing to grow up as a little kid with nobody dressing normally. You know, Sports Illustrated did an article about my father, and they asked him, what's the deal on your kid being this weird thing, this poet thing? And he said, that's not weird. I dress guys up in funny little outfits, and they bounce a ball and try to put it through a ring, and 20,000 people watch this, and you write about it. That's weird. That's very, very weird. And then as a little kid, I'm watching people, prancing around the living room in these funny little outfits again, only, you know, with big red noses and walking on wires and... What I learned wonderfully, and it didn't come too late, it came just at the right time. You know, the circus all went kaput because it was the greatest show on earth, and it's no longer able to be. And we had light shows and extravaganzas, and, you know, what are you going to do if you got an iPod? You know, go to the circus? But what I realized was these were people walking on wires. These were people flying through the air. These were people with big red noses slapping each other. But they were grown-ups. And that was the amazing thing, that they continued to bring that kind of magic into the world, no matter how many. They were doing that. They were adults. Something wonderful about that that has stayed. So I want to read a couple circus poems during this. This is the first one I want to read. Where'd it go? Circus, late summer. Now, when I grew up, my cousins, who was the circus guy, who was all but my mother's brother, and that's how the connection came, but it was always tent shows. That was the key thing. It had to be a tent show. And it still is. And as a little kid, I'd spend summer after summer. I was seven, 8 years old, this little redheaded kid doing a sideshow bar. Can you imagine this little kid out there? It's all politically incorrect now, but there's this little kid out there going, come on down in a little closer. Let me tell you about the strange people we have on the inside. Let your eyes wander down this long line of colored pictures and posters until they come to Johnny Banana. He's king of the jungle. He's in there right now eating snakes, bugs, insects of all kinds and waiting to talk to you. And it just goes on and on and on and on. I mean, every strange person on the inside. But they weren't strange to me. They were our pals. So it had to be a tent show, and there were these shows that are in one town only, you know, one day only, I mean, come to town, they laugh. Imagine that. They put that whole city up, take it down at the end of the day, back up in the next town. One time, it's always fun in the summer if you notice arrows on poles or trees. Those are signals for the circus trucks. They follow arrows instead of maps. They have no idea where they are. They just look, you know, two arrows up and one to the left, two more, and make a left turn, and that's how they get from one place to another. And I followed a truck once, and he got lost in downtown Grand Rapids. So I went up to him, and I said, you know, I don't know. He said, where am I? I said, well, what happened? He said, like, it was so wonderful because he had no idea I knew the language. And I said, what happened? He said, damn it, I blew an arrow. Isn't that just the best, you know? And I just thought, I'm an insider. That's cool, you know? That's cool. He blew an arrow. And they all waited up for him. We let him into the next place. I asked another person, where are you going next? He said, looked at me like I was just absolutely an idiot, and which was close. But he said, well, the next town. Yeah, the next town. That's where we're going. So this is the circus late summer. Everything is fading. The dark blue canopy of sky over the three rings is as washed out as an old pair of jeans. Its galaxy of bright white stars leaning into gray. The center poles, once varnished slick as the sideshow barker's pitch, now match the dust carried in from the back lot. It's late August. The elephants sway in the fly-biting heat, their dusty trunks twisting mats of hay into their hot mouths. The big cats sprawl against the bars of the cages, twitching their tails, staring, panting. The sequins on every costume have dimmed, their sparkle disappearing into the black holes of two shows a day. Tiaras sit tarnished on the dry hair of the queens of the air, high wire dancers, horses' backs. The red, blue, silver, gold hyperbole of the midway and the shrill paint along the sides of the semis have turned mute, their audacity of color as tame as a gentrified downtown. Even the balloon man's voice has dropped into a sandpapered plea. The ringmaster feels the weariness in his throat when he brings on the amazing Zambinis who will thrill you with pyromaniacal feats of flying flame. After the show, the roustabouts drag the tent like their own missed chance. The nights on the cots are hot. No one is clean. 2 months until winter quarters. A rain will cool things off and only make it worse. That's for Toby. Mm-hmm. Even though, he's the happy guy. little poem called The Line. Beginning of the line, 64 years ago, my mother and father got engaged. There's no need to know the date. April is enough. 2 years later, my mother lay alone and I was born, and my father lay on his cot in Belgium. Or was it France? No, he was being shipped to the Philippines, lying in a hammock, sick. We are all standing in line. The spaces between us, like those between these words. When he came home, I was two. I pointed at him and said, Dada. April's not that cruel. There are daffodils, pansies, antique blooms hold through any cold. The line we are in moves forward. It is generous to receive a handout, bread, a hat, even shoes or a book. Then he took her hand, slipped a ring onto her finger. It was quiet, she told me. There was a breeze. In April, there was always a breeze. There was also a war. 2 months later, she began reading the front page, began listening to the radio. It's difficult to know anyone else in a line except the persons behind and in front of you. Today, she keeps a vase of dried milkweed pods and gray-brown grasses on her kitchen table. There are many lines. Some are very long. Sometimes we even forget we are standing there. Then a tap on the shoulder and a nod to move ahead. This is... This is a little love poem, I think. You're never sure. You have to repair your house, right? I mean, that's why you own a house. And if there's something that needs to be repaired, you're supposed to repair it. And you think about the consequences. If you don't repair that, energy bills and mice and walls coming down and plaster, and those are the consequences. I was thinking about that because we had to repair the house. Who doesn't? And I started thinking, what if we don't repair the house? Maybe there are some good. Would there be any good from not repairing the house? And then it struck me, repair. You know, it means fix, and it also means to repair, to pair again. See how we're getting toward the love poem part? And then, genius poem guy wrote it in couplets. That was after the poem yelled at me and said, it should be in couplets, you imbecile. So, repairing the house. We'll learn the house can live without our changes. We will listen to its language. The cracks along the stairway, they are sentences. We will read what they say when we go up, again when we walk back down. When we leave our sleep, our beds will hold our place as the floor creaks under us. If we fix the broken window, then we will open it. The other windows rise on their tracks, that's enough. One staying shut, tight, will still bring light for any day, the other's the breeze. And we will learn to be with the ivy, straying along the back brick walls, twisting itself into the mortar, each spring a chunk or two falling into the holly. There's a draft under the porch door. We could block the cold from sliding toward our feet. Instead, we will wear socks, ones you made, while we sit facing each other, reading on the sofa, its stuffing shifting under us, pillows giving way to what is left. Two more, back to the circus. This is the cook. You know, the big show, and they get to do all this stuff, and the cook is, you know, there's always, like all of us have, we're on stage, but there's the people behind who really make these things happen, like for Chris and me tonight, and et cetera. But there's always that. And the cook knows that without him, you know, I mean, that the trapeze artist is not going to cook, for heaven's sakes. I always teach my students how you drink water when you do a poetry reading. I screwed it up there. You're supposed to say, go about halfway through a sentence, you say, you know, it's been a really nice time here tonight. You have to get all these affectations down. So the cook is fed up. He is really mad. He's just had it. And it's a persona poem. It's in the, obviously, it's in the voice of the cook. And then he changes his voice toward the end, which will be, I hope, obvious. So this is the fed-up circus cook. Damn, I love bacon grease. I'd love to be buried in the stuff. Just spread it over me. Let me smell it into heaven. What the hell? Into hell. Wouldn't that be something, me frying in my own grease? I've been with the show 30 years and hardly ever seen an act. The coffee's always ready, strong. Complaints? Cut it with some milk or water. They do two shows a day. I do three. Hell, I'm centering more than the elephants. Every day, I search out a grocery willing to sell all. It's lettuce, potatoes, buttered beans, bread, and chicken. Breakfast sits out all morning. By noon, I've spread a lunch for the roustabout, sweating and cranky after raising the big top and tightening the riggings. Dinner's on the planks by five. No flowers here. No candles. You want those, you bring them. Dishes and silverware steam overnight while the trucks haul ass for the next town. I'm up by 5 a.m. By 6, I've piled up the toast. I'm frying eggs. And there's the coffee. When I was a kid, I made all my own meals. Nothing fancy then, nothing fancy now. Why, I've got my own restaurant right here with no competition, no worries about pulling in customers. I've fried eggs in nearly every state. In the rain, the drought, through a couple tornadoes, winds that rip the canvas off the stakes. Sometimes I wonder about being a real chef. Dicing parsley, tossing croutons on a salad, coming up with recipes using olive oil. I often think about writing my own cookbook, Meals for the Center Ring, but I'd have to figure out portions. And who'd buy a book 4 pages long? Monday, breakfast, toast, coffee, eggs, bacon, hash browns. Lunch, sandwiches, soup in a kettle, iced tea, Jell-O. Dinner, hash browns, chicken, beans, bread, Jell-O. Any leftovers tossed together into circus surprise. Tuesday through Sunday, repeat. Vary amounts depending on number of roustabouts. After my finale, there's no bow, no applause. At each meal, the ringmaster should introduce me. Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, may I direct your attention to the center chopping block, to the amazing Hank, king of the culinary arts, master chef of the Midway, who will dazzle your taste buds with his mouth-watering fare. His expeditious, exotically delicious, stupendously resplendent, delectable delicacies concocted for your savory pleasure before the day has even dawned, before the stinking matinee, before the goddamn evening performance. All his ingredients gathered from the deepest, darkest aisles of your own local super value mart. A drum roll, please. And I'll say thank you. Actually, I'm going to keep you one more because I really didn't know about this. And this is Clown. This is for Toby. It's a little poem called Clown. And then I'll finish with another poem, if you'll let me. Just, you don't have to listen. This is just for Toby. Clown, every day disappears, rubbing the thick white paint deep into his web of wrinkles, down his leathered neck, across his forehead, watching the old skin turn into an interlocutor of laughs. He lives hidden behind the diamond eyes, red glob of a nose, mouth petrified wide in a grin. Every day, he's glad to lose his face behind the permanence of clown. Entering the center ring, he pushes a piglet in a wobbly wicker pram, stops under the spotlight, stoops, then slowly steps into a little red schoolhouse. The audience quiets, waits, and when the band plays Pomp and Circumstance, the pig, full grown, in cap and gown, strolls out, he trailing behind on a silver leash. They promenade once around the ring, then out back to the trailer where he hangs up the leash, sits, feels the entrance of gratitude for his red nose and graven smile. As he scrubs away the white face, red and yellow paint, the silver stars above each eyebrow, a face appears, one he doesn't recognize, one that stares, then turns away. I feel very lucky to do this, to let alone have had people like you all tonight, and Mary, Sarah, and Chris, and Sue wander into my, it's sappy, but wander in, they took up permanent residence. Actually, yeah, this is the second reading I've done this year with a former student. And I'm starting to think I should read them like this. This will be my last one. For the evening. There's a poem called The Materialism of Angels. And we're living in I started off with some sort of pontification about language, but we're also living in a really strange time about good work. About getting into heaven. And it's making me crazy. It's so oppressive, and it's so mean-spirited, and it's so austere, and it's so cruel, and you're supposed to get into heaven by that way. You know, like, okay, I feel miserable. It's just amazing to me. What are those people going to do if they get there? They're going to turn around and go, oh, my God, this is a happy place. I don't do happy. This is kind. I don't do kind. So this is my little tantrum against all that oppressive, cruel stuff. And it has a little epigraph from Charles Eames, the great designer Charles Eames, who said, who would say that pleasure is not useful? Who would say that? Isn't that wonderful? Who would say that pleasure is not useful? I'm not big on happy, but I'm big on joy, big on comfort. So this is my little tantrum against this. Materialism of angels. Thank you very much. Of course the angels dance. If not on the head of a pin, then along any boardwalk beside the ocean of stars. And they eat hot and spicy, salsa, Tabasco, red peppers. They love mangoes. They can munch for hours on cashews. Olives sit in bronze bowls on the cherry tables next to their canopy beds, with a solace of pillows, swallows, their sweet heads, and the quiet of silk lies across their happy backs. They know the altruism of material things. They want to say to us, we'll sleep next to you. Feel our soft and unimposing flutter across your shoulders, on your heartbroken feet. They want us to take, eat, smell the wood, run our tired fingers over the rim of every glass, give our eyes the chance to see the metal bend and curve its way into the black oval of a chair. They want us to feel the holiness of scratching where it itches. rubbing where it hurts. They want us to take long, steamy showers and a nap. They know how easily we follow directions, hook the red wire to the front of the furnace, fill in only the top half of the life insurance form. They have no manuals for joy. They can't fix anything we break. And they wonder why we never laugh enough, why we don't know God is crazy for deep massage and loves to wail on his alto sax whenever they dance. Thank you very, very much.